Welcome, podcast listening trainees, to the Three Men and a Retrospective's look at the entire Mission Impossible film franchise. Join IMF agents Garrett, Matt, and Adam as they review each film in the Tom Cruise starring saga about Daredevil agent Ethan Hunt and his team of world-saving emissaries. Pay attention, trainees, as knowledge of all that is discussed will determine whether you are worthy of joining the Impossible Mission Force. So strap yourselves in, IMF trainees. The Percolated Media Mission Impossible Retrospective begins now.
Mission Impossible Fallout, released July 27th, 2018. Budget was $180 million, which I call bullshit on. I think it was more than that. Box office was $791.7 million, and this was directed once again by Christopher McQuarrie. Matt, this is the movie that we led up to when we did this series initially, and I think it's safe to assume both of us were really excited for it. At least I was. What about you?
Oh, absolutely. This was the first one I was genuinely excited about from the moment I left Rogue Nation. Although I will say, as excited as I was, there was a part of me that was disappointed that they were bringing back McQuarrie to direct it. Not because I disliked his movie, in fact, far from it. But part of the novelty of this series to me and to others has been bringing in different filmmakers to lend a distinct voice and particular style. So the fact that they were, to me, taking a series that was pretty good about being sort of serialized, sort of like Jack Reacher, where there's not one continuous story, it's a bunch of adventures. I was worried that they were starting to turn this more into a what we think of a modern day movie franchise where everything has to be interconnected and build off of it. So I was kind of trepidatious on the surface because that's what it looked like they were doing to this. And that's not what I wanted because we were getting enough of that with not just Marvel and DC, but another franchise that Tom Cruise tried to attach himself to in between missions.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that here in a bit. And you know what? McQuarrie was very conscious of that to the point where he brought nobody back from Rogue Nation. He hired a whole new crew, including a new director of photography. And this is a guy who worked a lot with Adam's hero, Alex Garland, on Annihilation and Ex Machina. So this movie has a whole new look. And if anything, I mean, he tried to distinguish it as much as he could. But you're right. It's still the same director, which this franchise has always gone different. Now, Adam, Matt, and I, we have thrown our thoughts out there, even though they'll never see the light of day until this particular podcast. Sir, what were your expectations coming into Mission Impossible Fallout?
I got to say, they were pretty high. They were pretty big because I felt since 3 kind of reinvented what this franchise was going to be about, I feel like they'd steadily gotten better and better and better. I held Matt's trepidation on McQuarrie coming back, though. This series had differentiated itself by having a different director, a different vision every movie. I found it funny, and I listened to a lot of interviews back then and again now for this, that McQuarrie, he came back, but in his infinite wisdom decided, oh, I must be the only one that returned, so I'm going to fire the crew and hire a new one.
Yeah.
I understand his reasoning behind it, but I'm like, that sucks for the crew. But I was extremely excited. I felt like this series had really worked to build itself, that you know, that a fuse had been lit, and it felt like this was going to be the end at the time, that this was really setting itself up to be a grand finale. And I was excited from just the marketing, from the casting that was put in place. I was ready for this thing to blow.
I wasn't really excited. And then I saw that trailer, the famous trailer with Henry Cavill just loading up his arms and getting ready to fight in this bathroom. And is he going after Cruise? Who's he going after in that bathroom? And it really set me up for something that I was extremely excited for. And once this thing came out, I mean, we were having Dark Knight comparisons. There were a lot of critics saying this was the best action film in years. And so, yeah, once it was finally getting close, I was getting excited for it as well.
Well, it's funny you mention that because this got the same amount of hype that Mad Max Fury Road did. And it was kind of a similar conversation where the term best action film of the decade, some would say even longer, was being thrown around. And I did my best to taper my expectations because that's a high bar to cross, especially for someone like me who loves Fury Road. But at the same time, I was also excited because of the I saw the budget, and you mentioned it was what did you say it was, like 180?
180, yeah. Which I call bullshit on. I don't think
it's... Well, part of that is also to protect the biggest asset in this movie, and that is the mustache that sank a franchise. Because remember, this came out after Justice League, and all of us who were walking out of that theater depressed sort of said, all right, this Mission Impossible movie better be fucking amazing to justify justify all the nonsense that they went through.
We'll talk about that when we get to his scenes.
I swear that was an extra $15 to $20 million worth of marketing alone just by the press about that fucking Mustang.
Let's talk about the star of this film, the star of this franchise, Tom Cruise. Now, guys, I have a theory. Around Mission Impossible...
He's about to sell us on Scientology.
In the press leading up to Mission Impossible 3, the three of us discussed the fact that his personal life was not looking good to everybody, and he himself was not looking good, and he was a PR nightmare. Around the time this movie and the last movie, and the movie, even the movie before that, when he was up on the Burj Khalifa, all the talk about these films have been about the stunts that Cruise has done, right? And it's kind of interesting that we have not discussed his personal life because it has been hidden around the fact that he has been concentrated on two things, being a movie star and Scientology. And I do think that was an interesting way of throwing the press off, saying, look what he's done for this movie. And this movie is another one. I mean, he's got stunts that would kill a normal person, but here he is. One of them almost crippled him. We'll discuss that. But Matt, did you notice that? Did you notice the swing of press that went from his personal life to the stunts that goes into these films?
Well, by this point, they had established a precedent that part of the appeal of these movies was the practical stunt work, so much so that they sold the last two movies, both with the marketing and especially the poster with the fifth one, on Tom Cruise doing something crazy. But at the same time, I was getting worried because I'm like, how much more, if you got to keep topping yourself, how much more extreme can you get than hanging off of a freaking side of a plane? Because I have to compare this to this franchise because I think they're very similar. Around this time, Fast and Furious was sort of at its apex. We're a couple years removed from the seventh one, which I think should have been the end of the franchise for all things considered. Because by the time the eighth one came out, they got so ridiculous that I no longer... like this series was going downhill for me. And I was worried that this one was going to follow suit, in the sense that they felt like they had to consistently keep topping themselves to the point where I can't look at these in any semblance of reality, which is a contradiction when you have all the practicality, but it's established in a world that has gotten so ridiculous that it's hard to get to buy into it.
I think it's twofold. Like, I think that it's been a smart decision and it's taken years, but it has reshaped the discussion. And I think that, I mean, there was a lot of damage done after not just his antics, but there was a couple of documentaries that came out that were pretty enlightening to a lot of people. Not to mention, look at Remini's series and everything else. I gotta say that whatever PR person on the DL is shaping the stuff, they deserve all the credit. And I'm sure they're probably being hidden away like Tom Cruise in a van with a hood over their head. But you kind of got to appreciate it. Like he took the narrative away and he said, you know what? Fuck it. It's about the movie. And I got issues with Scientology for a lot of fucking reasons, but I appreciate the move because I got tired of talking about it as well.
All right. So while Cruise's personal life was hidden, nobody knew who he was dating around this time. In fact, when this movie was coming out, I believe he was unattached. What wasn't hidden was his career trajectory, which I always discuss before we get into these films. And the release of Fallout and Rogue Nation was 3 years. So it was the shortest amount of time between sequels that we'd seen at this point. But Cruise still had three movies that he had done in between. One was Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, which the three of us were talking off mic. Matt, you say it's pretty bad, right?
No, the second one's pretty bad.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one that I'm talking about.
Yeah, Never Go Back is the appropriate title because we're not getting another one.
Okay. And after that, it's another one that the three of us have kind of reamed over the years on this podcast, even though I myself have never seen it, The Mummy. Now, from what I hear, there's a fantastic stunt that he does in the beginning of that one that is really good, and then the movie just falls off a cliff after that. Matt, what is your assessment of The Mummy?
It's sort of like watching the helicopters at the end of this movie. When it lights on fire, it crashes into a cliff, they get shot out of it like a cannon and just roll on the ground writhing in pain. I think that's a pretty memorable summarization of how much of a failure that movie is in the grand scheme of filmmaking. At least DC and Warner Brothers can say they got to make like 10 plus movies. They got one, and it was such a disaster of of studio meddling. That movie has like 8 writers on it. They photoshopped a freaking cast together to try to get people to buy in. I think it will go down and will continue to go down as one of the biggest creative missteps in Hollywood's never-ending saga to both resurrect the Universal Monsters for established continuity, but also just starting a franchise in general, because that was supposed to launch this whole pantheon, new versions of like the Universal Monsters. But look, if that movie had to die and be sacrificed for me to get Lee Winnell's The Invisible Man, I'll take the price. Although the Wolfman sucked. I know that had some issues behind the scenes as well. I don't even remember the big stunt Tom Cruise does at the start of that movie, because A, I've only seen it once, and B, one of the worst things about the movie is Tom Cruise. Like, he is so wrong for that role, it's not even funny.
Well, they did two, if you count Dracula Untold.
Well, yeah, that was supposed to launch. And there, remember, Van Helsing was also supposed to do that. But that shit the bed, too.
For the 45 minutes of it that I watched, there was, I think Tom Cruise was in the belly of a plane that crashed. I think that's what, and that's kind of how the movie went. Though it makes me think, I think I'm going to need to make a shirt of that Photoshop photo of the entire Dark Universe cast. I think that's going to be my shirt that I wear to Epic Universe this fall.
All right. And then we get a movie that, another one I haven't seen, but of all people, my mother raves about this movie, and she, like my fiance, hates Tom Cruise with a passion. Yet she really likes a movie that he did called American Made. Matt, did you see that one?
I did. That I remember liking, but I've only seen it the one time. But it's I don't want to call it fluff, but it's pretty light. It's just disposable fun, although it is based on a true story. I think it's good. I just don't think it's especially memorable.
Yeah, that's one. I think it's good. I think it's, to me, American Made is kind of like Air America. It is an underrated movie that really has got some good stuff throughout.
The problem, though, with that and the Mummy is that it gives into the worst tendency of not just Tom Cruise, but modern Hollywood, where you cast a guy in his 50s and give him a 25, 30-year-old spouse or girlfriend, which they do with both of those.
Yep.
All right, boys. What do you say we get into this plot? Because, my God, this...
Good luck.
Oh, my God. This really sucked.
This is your mission.
This sucked. Just really sucked putting this together. And I'll just say right off the bat, this fucking plot is needlessly complicated, but let's get to it. So we open up, we're hearing some drums, and we see a few logos before we cut to a wedding between Ethan and Julia being conducted by Solomon Lane. What? Who gives a set of vows I think me and Jen are going to give when we get our wedding going. Now, this is obviously a dream, as a nuclear blast is about to take them out and Ethan wakes up. Matt, what do you think about opening this up with a nightmare like this?
I got a little worried because I don't want the pompous, philosophical house type of Mission Impossible film. And because, like I said previously, I don't think these movies are particularly deep with characterization. And I haven't viewed that as a bad thing with the last couple, because I still don't give a fuck about Ethan Hunt. And it's been 2+ movies since they've really touched on this. It's the ending of the fourth one, which really acts as what you think is the resolution to be like, yeah, we're acknowledging the last movie, but we're moving on. To then reincorporate it, I was confused by, and I never like, with very few exceptions, dream sequences to start a movie.
It's an interesting way to start. It feels like it is a two-parter, though. I think it's kind of telling us, hey, this is the first direct sequel to something. Though, you almost needed to put a caption to say, hey, this is your villain from the last film, because Lane is unrecognizable in that glue-on beard.
Oh, is he ever. We're seeing Ethan in a very downtrodden apartment. You know, we've always seen him amongst luxurious living means, I guess. And here we have this apartment that he's waking up in. He's got this heater right next to him. Like, this is not how I would envision Ethan living.
Well, I don't even know if it's his apartment. He's like on a cot in the middle of Berlin. So I assume he's just stationed there on assignment, or he's on like just scouting something out and he was expecting this. But as it stands, I think this is one of the instances where I think this is a little closer to like the Daniel Craig Bonds, where we have to put him at his low point consistently and he's not, can't be without all of his tech. Mm-hmm. It's just weird to do that with the sixth movie, considering all of the other movies he's borderline untouchable, especially the second one.
Yeah. There's a knock on the door as a door dasher gives some code words, and Ethan has his new mission. Ethan opens it up, and he's told that Lane's capture has had severe world consequence. His syndicate continues to wreak havoc under the name of the Apostles. They are responsible for a smallpox outbreak in China and Pakistan, and while the outbreak is being contained, intelligence says a new client has been hired by them for a new operation. They've been contacted by John Lark, who has made a manifesto calling for the destruction of the current world order. Lark's believed to be responsible...
This message has been brought to you by the NWO.
Lark's believed to be responsible for the disappearance of nuclear weapons specialist Niles DeBrook, as his security clearance has been revoked. The Apostles also have been contacted by elements of the Eastern European underworld, who are now in possession of 3 plutonium cores stolen from a running missile bay.
Okay, so, lots to unpack there.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll say what I like about this is it's kind of a summation of the entire franchise when you look at the disparate elements. You're following up on the last movie with Solomon Lane and the literal fallout of that. You have nuclear weapons, which we've dealt with in Ghost Protocol. You have like an anonymous villain, which we've played with. Arms dealer. Kind of the third one. I like that this is kind of the culmination of everything this franchise has done at that point, condensed into one plot. But I also like that they also acknowledge the second one with like biological warfare with the smallpox outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that they're, while I normally protest member berries and callbacks, for the context of this movie, which is really about the consequences of this franchise and bringing everything as full circle as they can, I think it's warranted, .. if this was the last movie.
I think that's where we get some issues later on. This is set up for a finale because, to Matt's point, this is kind of, here's everything that's happened in this franchise. Now you have consequences for your actions. I like that part of it. Hey, you thought you did good, but guess what? Because you did something and you did it on your own, you know, you went rogue and this is the consequence of it. I like that. I don't like that this DoorDasher doesn't know what to say and he has to be given the lines, because by the rules of what we know, Ethan should have pulled out his gun and shot the dude dead. Like, he doesn't know what the hell he's doing, and that's a problem when you're fucking doing a drop. But yeah, this is a Craig setup. You know, this is going much more towards that type of feel, and I'm down for it. I mean, Tom Cruise is, you know, at this point 50, acting like he's 30, and I'm bought right back in.
And it's also kind of, in the same way that Rogue Nation was Spectre done better, this is kind of the first act of No Time to Die, where it's like, okay, Blofeld's been captured, but we have to wrap up Spectre somehow, so we're just going to get them out of the way in the first act. I like that here we're seeing what happens when the evil organization loses their leader, and you have like literally a splinter cell of radicals that are basically just mercenaries for hire. But also this depiction between this and Rogue Nation, this is how Spectre should have been modernized for the Craig era, where it's not so much destabilizing governments as far as like assassinations and stuff. It's the, you know, the motto, like the greater the suffering, the greater the peace, or whatever it is. They have like a creed and they'll do it by any means necessary, various methods. I think this was the way to do it. And again, I'm happy that I'm seeing it done right in my mind. I just wish that it was in the Bond films and not this. Call me a purist or whatever. It's sad when the American version does it better, but I like this setup a lot. And also, they jumped 2 years, so it makes sense that everything's kind of going to shit.
It should be said that the script for this, believe it or not, it was 33 pages. Now, for people who know script writing and film, a page of script is usually a minute of film. So there's obviously been a lot of additions here, a lot of things added, a lot of ad-libbing, which we'll talk about. Despite that, though, as I mentioned, I think the script at times is needlessly complicated, especially in this first 30 minutes or so. But here, I'm liking, as you mentioned, Matt, everything that we've seen previously is being included. So this would seem to be the last mission that he's going to go on.
You mentioned additions. There's also an important subtraction that we should mention. It was publicized that Jeremy Renner was not going to be in this one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to talk about that when we talk about the shooting here in a bit, but go ahead.
Well, I was gonna get to that, but I kind of went into the theater saying, oh, maybe he's in it and they're keeping it secret, because he's not in Infinity War, which was the whole like reason we thought, okay, if I'm going to pick the biggest Marvel movie ever or be third banana in another Mission Impossible movie, I'd rather go with Marvel. And then he's not in the fucking movie. So I was like, okay, what the fuck happened? Did he have a fight with Tom Cruise and he pulled rank? Like, what was the deal?
What he said later on, because he didn't do it around the time the movie was coming out, because again, we thought he was filming Infinity War. But what he said was, when he got the script, you know, McCrory had to choose. He had to kill somebody. Was it going to be Benji? Was it going to be Luther? Or was it going to be Brandt? Well, he picked Brandt, and fucking Renner, the crybaby that he is, was like, well, I don't want to be killed that way. I don't want my character to be treated that way. So he decided, in his mind, he decided not to do it. But would that be Alien 3-ing it, though? Would that be Alien 3-ing it? Would that be taking a character who we've seen the previous two films and just completely killing him off without any rhyme or reason?
Well, of the three that you mentioned, he's by far the most expendable.
Exactly.
So I think it would have been justified, but he's also... Look, I like Simon Pegg. I like Ving Rhames. Jeremy Renner, I would say, had the most face value because of his association with Marvel. So it's kind of like killing off your quote-unquote biggest star, but he's a medium-sized fish next to the giant basking whale that is Tom Cruise. So I kind of understand that, but I also don't think it would have been Alien 3 because there would be thematic resonance if something that he did either got himself killed or Ethan had to make a decision to where, you know, Renner couldn't... He thought, Brandt thought he didn't save his wife. Ethan couldn't save Brandt. You could have done something with that.
Of course. And I think that's the first time Cruise has ever been compared to a giant whale. Adam, how do you feel about this?
It was clear two films ago he was kind of brought in to take over the franchise, and much like Bourne, didn't work out. Oh, if he's not going to be part of the team, you know, and if you don't want him to play third fiddle, fourth banana, you know, you're just going to keep pushing him down the list as you introduce new people, then yeah, you kind of got to get rid of him. But I think you could do it in a good way of watching him sacrifice himself for the team. Because nobody else on the team has had to give a life. So, yeah, I think there's a way to do it really well. Or even, I don't know, maybe to make the Apostles look like a threat by having them kill him off. Something that you would have happen in a Bond film where your big bad kills somebody who matters to your protagonist. I forgot that he wasn't in this film until I started watching it.
So just to finish out the mission that Ethan gets. So with the Doctor in their possession, the Apostles can complete three nuclear weapons in a 72-hour time frame. And Ethan's mission is to prevent the Apostles from acquiring the plutonium using any means necessary. Guys, I haven't heard plutonium used this much in a movie since Back to the Future, for Christ's sake.
I was going to say, this plot in this movie... It's not just comparable to The Dark Knight. There's a lot of Nolan influence in this.
Oh, specifically, positively.
Yeah. I was thinking Dark Knight Rises with the whole... That movie opens with them capturing a nuclear physicist.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, you're already being pretty Nolan-esque with the visual aesthetic, and the score in particular,
mm-hmm.
I think has a lot of Hans Zimmer Dark Knight parallels.
Yeah, well, Lorne Balfe was an underling of Hans Zimmer, so I do feel that influence as well.
Yeah, to me, the way this plot is set up, and even throughout, I find it extremely lazy. I feel like they took the plot for 4 and just reworked it here. Like, we saw this. We saw somebody who wanted a nuclear weapon. We saw this chase for a plutonium. This was all already done. And to do the exact same thing doesn't sit well with me. It just doesn't.
Yeah, and the only way they kind of, I don't want to say improve or do something different, is they take the trope of the first one of him having to pose as someone else.
Yep.
Yeah.
To get closer.
Even the goals that, oh, we're just here to spread fear and terror because it's going to make a new world order. Outsiders. It's like, I'm glad we didn't bring back the car fucking elevator, I guess, by the finale of this film.
The original conception of this was having Ethan go as John Lark and have him do things that he was always against doing in previous films and have himself move on to the dark side, I guess you can say. But instead, they reconceptualized it, and we'll talk about who they added here in a bit. But Adam, would you have gone with that? Would you have been able to go with Ethan doing dark things as we go into the plot? Or how are you feeling about that?
Not this far into the franchise. I think you could do it. I think you could do it in a film with Tom Cruise. I think you look at something, we've mentioned it before, but you look at something like Collateral. I think he has the ability to be a really good anti-hero type of character. But in film 6, no. You know you're not going to do it. You're going to flash the whites. You're going to smile. I do think this movie tries to have its cake and eat it too in a couple sequences where they do that trope. But no, it's too late to try to do that.
I agree, and they completely wasted that opportunity by going for Chimera in the second movie. Yeah, that could have been an interesting plot for the second one, for sure.
There's no chance it would have been convincing, because this character, as he is, he's gone rogue, but he's never, like, embraced the dark side or really done anything super heinous. Because even something like Nolan's Batman, he does some really questionable things. Craig's Bond, you could argue, crossed the line a couple times. Mm-hmm. Especially Casino Royale, where he's just the Punisher, taking people out left and right, no questions asked. Ethan Hunt's never been like that. So it would have been too far of a stretch, and neither the audience nor the other characters would have done that. And more importantly, if you ran with that plot, not just because there's so much running in this movie, you really would have sidelined everyone else. And you would have taken away what people have grown to appreciate with the series from basically remnants of 3, but in particular with 4 and 5, with the other characters that they incorporate.
So we cut to Ethan and Benji as they're waiting for somebody, as Luther is seen clean shaven here, and we're getting some nice rapport here. I always like seeing these three together. Guys, we mentioned the new DP. The look of this film, so much different than the previous film. Everything's dark. We have a lot of orange hues going on here. Adam, how do you feel about the look of this film?
I think it's fine. I think it's done in service of what we have, but I don't think it's as crisp as what we got before, but I don't think it's necessarily done in the same locales. So I think changing was appropriate because you're shooting a different looking film, but nothing stands out to me as glorious as it did the last few films we reviewed in the way of cinematography.
Yeah, I don't think it's as pristine as the last one, but I still like it. I will say, though, there are some parts later on, especially in the bunker when the lights get cut, it's kind of hard to make out what's happening. And I know people are going to say, well, that's because they cut the power. I'm like, well, you could still frame your shots to reflect shadows and things like that, especially with all the muzzle flares that go off. So I think the visual look is fine, but I was really disappointed that we didn't have the same cinematographer from the last movie. Because I was like, okay, if you're going to bring the director back, then I want more of the same in that regard, because I liked it so much.
So we see some agents show up as Luther's van is shut down and taken out. Was this done by John Lark?
Also, nice callback to the second movie.
Second movie.
Because Luther almost
gets blown up. Cool. There's some negotiations going on as we see the three cores mentioned earlier. Benji's getting a reaction out of his device with the cores as the money is being called for. But Luther is not coming out with the money. Shots ring out as Hunt hears a voice saying to them to get the plutonium and walk away. Benji calls for the car. Ethan makes the choice to save Luther instead of doing the deal. He shoots and he thinks he shot Luther, and they ask why they're not dead. They see that the plutonium is gone, and we're seeing the results of 3 nuclear blasts being given, who we think... Oh, we'll talk about that here in a bit. But boys, how do you feel about the way this this deal goes on?
So I was laughing at the beginning because I was thinking of that scene in The Departed when they're exchanging the microchips. That's where my brain always goes, especially because it's at night. But I'm fine with the decision to not off Luther, because this movie is basically, in a lot of ways, a remake of Wrath of Khan. And I don't just say that because Bad Robot produced this, but this movie is ultimately about the moral struggle in Ethan of the needs of the many versus the needs of the one. And is it worth saving one person if it means you put other people at risk? Because this guy, I've never really got a read on him as far as a character, a guy that invested. So at least give me a mantra or a code for me that he has to abide by that justifies all of his decisions. Because he's always been very well-intentioned. These movies have been pretty apolitical. So his actions don't come off as just being rah-rah America, you know, Team America. But in a movie that's all about the cost of that, I'm glad they're giving me something to latch on to.
Dig this scene. It's done a little different. This feels very... I don't want to compare, but I think this is almost the first film where you can really, really compare some of the ideals. And maybe it was shorthand on their end, but this feels like something we would see James do in a Bond film. I like this. I like this well. It's kinetic. Shooting Luther and you don't know what the hell, though you know you didn't kill him. It's good. And again, it plays to the results of your actions set up what's going on. He made a choice again, and the choice of that action again fails the world. And what is the fallout of your actions?
But I also, in the same way that franchises like this borrows a lot from Nolan, this is also the Skyfall thing of, oh, you fucked up.
Yeah.
So we're seeing the results of 3 nuclear blasts being given by who we think is Wolf Blitzer.
Speaking of Skyfall, he was also in that.
I know. As this is going on, we see the doctor mentioned earlier. He starts waking up. Ethan and Luther interrogate him, and he says that there's never been peace without suffering, and when they read the manifesto, they will understand. They ask where Lark is, but the doctor says that Ethan is the enemy. Ethan goes after him, and Luther offers to read Lark's manifesto on the air. Ethan makes a phone call, and Blitzer reads the manifesto, which of course is a bunch of bullshit. Do these fucking manifestos ever make sense?
This is what happens when you get, like, high school philosophy students that are held at gunpoint to write something that they think is meaningful, but it's nothing but pontification.
Yes.
And what, even if this was reality, why would the Lark slash the apostles, I keep wanting to say acolytes, even though I know that's not right. Because this also starts the trend. If you notice, they're the apostles, and the places that are bombed are all holy areas. So this movie's really establishing that the Syndicate does not like organized religion.
Yeah.
I bet they like one. That needs spaceships.
Yes. The doctor says, what's done is done. As Luther says, we got it. The ruse is found out. And dun-dun-dun, Blitzer reveals himself to be Benji.
This would have been so much better if they just paid Wolf Blitzer. And it was revealed he was an IMF agent all along.
Oh my God, playing to the media being complicit into all this kind of stuff. I gotta say though, I like that. This is fun.
I liked it
like
too.
When the walls drop away and they're in this thing and they're breaking down, that happened an hour ago. This is fun. I do think, you know, this starts out a little morose and you need some just light injected into it, and this does that for me.
Yeah, because you definitely, with this movie, you don't want it to be too dour or too simplistic with its writing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because this plot, as we'll talk about, it's a little bit more complicated, more like the first one where it's needlessly convoluted in certain aspects. But I like that this brings back the fun of like being a spy where you actively trick somebody. Again, it's kind of like the second one when he tricks Brendan Gleeson.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the hospital. So I like that this movie is breaking the trend of, oh, we're going to acknowledge all the movies in some way, including the freaking cliff climbing at the start of the second one. Technically, that plays a role of all things. So this is, to me, like, quote-unquote, good fan service or calling back. Because there's something coming up that I rolled my eyes at when they first said it. But I thought this opening was good. I was surprised how long it was, all things considered.
Yeah, 18 minutes, and we get our title sequence.
And the freaking, I was thinking of Monsters, Inc., Adam, when the walls come down.
Mr. Water News, yes.
Yeah, don't let McQuarrie hear you say fan service, because that's one phrase he hates. But
A sequel is fan service.
You're absolutely douche. Right.
Cinema is fan service in and of itself.
Exactly.
You want money? You want me to buy a ticket? Guess what that fucking, guess what my dollar is?
Entertainment is all about pleasing your audience.
So we see Alan waiting for Ethan, who doesn't pull up in a motorcycle but a car. And Alan says that their leads led them to someone going by the name of the White Widow, who's also in arms dealing. I like seeing Alec Baldwin back, and I like the fact that, you know, we left the last film with him being head of IMF, and here he is saying that, you know, the reason why he's here is because of Ethan, you know, and he hates the fact that he had to make the terrible decision that he did.
Yeah, not to mention, first time we got a returning secretary-type character. Yep. You know, he wasn't technically the secretary until the end of the first one, but we always get this person who's in charge. And sometimes they're the secretary, sometimes they're not, in the way of Anthony Hopkins' character. First one returning. Great. I can't wait to see him last the rest of this franchise. Way to go. I don't like Baldwin. I don't, but I like him in this.
I was surprised to see him back, because I thought with Jeremy Renner leaving, I'm like, oh, there's no chance they'll get Alec Baldwin back. And I saw him show up. I'm like, oh, I thought this was going to be the only scene he was in.
Me too. All right. We meet Erica Sloan and August Walker, played by Angela Bassett and a famously mustached Henry Cavill. All right, boys, let's talk about this. So Chris McQuarrie himself, I heard him in interviews, and he said that he wanted to help the Justice League.
He wanted to do Man of Steel, too.
Yeah.
So do I.
League said, look, we need him, and we need him shaven because he's going to be Superman. We need him for reshoots for Justice League. McQuarrie said, okay, you can do that, but give us the $3 million it's going to cost for us to CGI the mustache back on when he comes back. And Warner Brothers agreed to that, but when Paramount got word of that, they were like, you're going to do what? And they called a halt to it, so it ended up being the reverse. He does those scenes with the mustache on, and we discussed that a couple years ago, the results of what happened with that. Adam, last week you said this is the mustache that took down a franchise. We'll talk about Henry Cavill and his presence here in a bit, but how do you feel about the whole hoopla about this whole mustache thing?
Nothing did as much press as fucking Tom Cruise did on the press tour itself. You might as well have just sat it down in front of Access Hollywood and let the mustache speak. I don't know how many extra tickets it sold just because of the hoopla, but it did. And I got to tell you, it's a fine mustache, but Burt Reynolds is out there saying, boy, that ain't no mustache.
Well, he's the one who went to McQuarrie with it, and McQuarrie went with it. He's like, yeah, you're the villain of this movie. You fucking come in with the mustache. That's perfect. And Cavill does everything except troll it in this fucking thing.
It fits him for some reason. Mm-hmm. It's funny. He still does these weird lip curls that make it seem like it's pasted on, even though it's not. But yeah, it fits him, you know, and I'm sure men and women alike are wanting to take that mustache ride.
Yeah, not since Alex Trebek has the removal of a mustache caused so much controversy. It's amazing that this thing was almost as discussed as the stunt work in the movie. But I think part of that was also, if Justice League had been a really good movie, I don't think anyone would have cared. But the fact that it was not well received and the removal effects were so bad that it looked like he just had like plastic surgery, it made it 10 times worse looking back at it. But facially, I think Cavill's got the bone structure to actually pull off a mustache because he's got sort of angular cheekbones and really strong jawline, so he can pull it off. Like, not everyone is meant to have one.
If they didn't need to go back and spend fucking tens of millions of dollars on reshoots, it wouldn't have been an issue.
Or they could have actually put the movie on the shelf and either let Snyder come back when he was ready or just can the movie.
Shocking. Warner Brothers dropped the ball on that.
Speaking of ball dropping, which is literally what this movie is, because these plutonium bombs are basically like croquet balls. His handler was also someone Warner Brothers dropped the ball with their DC franchise.
Yeah. All right. So now that we got the mustache talk out of the way, let's talk about the casting of Henry Cavill. Now, I spoke about Cruise's career trajectory, you know, in the 3 years since this movie and Rogue Nation, but Cruise was actually supposed to be in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and he pulled out of that, and Henry Cavill kind of stepped in, and Cruise in that time spoke to Cavill and said, you know what, I think you'd be good in this movie, and he recommended him to McQuarrie. McQuarrie completely agreed. You know, I think Cavill's fine here, but I don't find him to have any presence. He's a big dude. I get it. You get him here. I know he wanted to be Bond, so this is probably the closest he's ever going to get to that, but he makes no impression on me one way or the other.
I think he's a villain that's finally a good freaking presence in here. I mean, you got to go back to number two to one that's going to get fisticuffs with Cruise in a way that's believable. You know, we didn't get that with Hoffman, and then you got old Russian guy and other people. So I think he's a good foil. You know, you get somebody who's jaws with personality. You know, he's got the build, but he's going to do more than just stand there. And I think he's a good choice. It is funny that he's not going to play Bond as a British guy, but he's going to play an American agent. And then even in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., he doesn't play the European, he plays the American. So Cavill, you know, he's got a type. I think he's a really good casting for this. I think he got a lot of people excited to see this film, just to see these two go tete-a-tete. He was riding high as Superman. You know, I'm one of the few that think Man of Steel is a decent film. Justice League be damned. Yeah, I was excited, and I think he's a good choice. And I think he brings some energy into a villainous role.
Yeah, go back in the archives at percolatedmedia.net and check out our reviews of those. Justice League and Man of Steel, we give our total thoughts on that. Matt, how do you feel about the Cavill casting, sir?
So the casting I was interested in, but I also don't like that they spoiled he was the villain. Not that it's a genuine surprise or anything, but both the casting announcement said Henry Cavill as the villain. That was the first thing that came out. And then in the trailer, they show him firing the machine gun out of the helicopter, which clearly, it's obvious he's shooting at Ethan based on how it's framed. So I wish that didn't get spoiled, but like I said, not that it is a genuine surprise. I think he's really good in this because he's got obviously a tremendous physical presence. I mean, part of that is why he was cast as Superman in the first place. But I will say, I like him better in the second half of the movie when he gets to open up a little bit more, when he actually gets to play the villain proper. I think in the first half, when he's quote-unquote undercover, which, talk about needlessly complicated, the lengths this guy went through to infiltrate the CIA is fucking ridiculous. But be that as it may, I like the rapport he has with Cruz. I think it's an interesting dynamic to actually give him, I don't want to call Jeremy Renner a lackey, but by comparison, to a certain degree, they don't hold a candle in the charisma department. While I wouldn't say Cavill has like Tom Cruise's like movie star quality, I think his physical presence combined with the fact that he's just so much fucking bigger than Tom Cruise makes it fun. And there's always a fun odd couple dynamic with giving Tom Cruise, like, this is the first time they've given him like a true like partner that's on his equal playing field, but they genuinely don't like each other.
See, I didn't mind the reveal that he was the villain, because when he walks on with the mustache, you know right away. I mean, true, you're gonna have to see the machinations of how he turns on Cruz and how he is revealed to be the villain, which we'll talk about when we get to it. But I had absolutely no qualms about that, because I would have known right away anyway. He is the villain of this movie. Cruz is not going to have another partner here. So Angela Bassett's character, Verica Sloan, she's sick of Ethan's shit, so she's sending Walker to help the IMF, who she labels as Halloween, aka people playing dress up with fake masks. She demands that Walker go, and Alan hesitantly abides.
I also love how they're framed like two kids who got in a schoolyard fight on the playground, and the parents have to show up and talk to the principal while they're standing there.
I know. They get on the plane as Ethan gives Walker the rundown of the mission. Now, this movie, it's very low on gadgets, but I do like the ones we get. You know,
the wristband.
Yeah, that stuff's fun.
I also just can't stop laughing that this is the second movie where Henry Cavill / Superman has worked for an Amanda Waller, because it's revealed in Black Adam that Superman's in league with her, and then let's not forget Angela Bassett was playing Amanda Waller in Green Lantern.
Oh, that's right.
That's why I said that. I mean, she was perfect casting, and they did fucking nothing with her. So I'm happy that she's here. She's certainly a presence. But at the same time, she's also here just to give another... The IMF always has to have conflict with the CIA.
Yep.
It's a trope they just can't get past.
Ethan questions Walker's methods as they suit up. And, okay, let's discuss this fucking Halo jump. Does Cruz have a fucking death wish? Jesus Christ. Normally it takes about 10,000 jumps to get this right, but he did 100 jumps or so, and they also had to train a cameraman to make this jump because he's the one who follows them on the way down. I thought this was CGI when I first saw it, but when I started watching making ofs of this, I'm like, holy shit, he actually did do that jump. And Cavill said, fuck no, I won't do that. So he has a stuntman. This looked great on the big screen, although I didn't need the storm. I thought that was one thing too many. This is an amazing feat, but I don't think it's that thrilling.
I think it looks amazing. I think you needed this kind of action piece. I think this is Tom Cruise wanting to write off his skydiving that he does in his personal life, so he gets to put it on a line item for Paramount. Way to go. This is, I think it's pretty damn great. The storm, look, if you get struck by lightning as you're going through, I don't think all it's going to do is short out your equipment. I think you might be a little more fucked up, but that's just me. I like this, though. I think it's pretty badass. When you see it on the big screen, it feels pretty claustrophobic as well, mm-hmm. because it goes really dark. It goes light. I like the transition through the clouds. It loses a little bit when you're watching it at home, but this is pretty fucking awesome.
I appreciate the sound design where the sound just cuts.
Yep.
Yep.
And there's no score. I mean, it's hard to be anything but unimpressed considering what these guys do and the practicality of it. But to Adam's point, yeah, if you get struck by lightning, he should have been like instantly vaporized.
Yeah.
Because if you know anything about lightning, it's highly pressurized heat. So I find that I was getting a little worried. I'm like, okay, I'm willing to go with you guys because you're putting the work in, but that's you're stretching the limit of plausibility with that. If there was no storm, I think it would have been even better. That just feels like, oh, we have to throw in another obstacle. Yep. Because Ethan Hunt in this movie is literally the Messiah.
I mean, if this was done on the ground, he'd be outrunning lightning bolts. So I guess this is...
Hell, yeah, he might be shooting
out. If you swap out Henry Cavill for Chris Hemsworth, I would have had fun with this.
Oh, shit, that'd be great. Ethan loses Walker in the air for a few minutes before finding him. He struggles with him in the air as the countdown to how long they have echoes in the background. Parachutes deploy, and I have to ask, boys, why did they have to land here from the air? Because once they land, they get in their freaking disguises anyway.
I guess it's quicker than driving. Because she says you only have 2 hours. They're kind of on a clock. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, you guys didn't see the forecast before you took off?
Yeah, exactly. Read a weather report. They enter the club, a place I would have loved to be in my mid-20s, but I look at this now, I'm like, my God, all the people.
No, it's not just the people, it's the noise.
Yeah, the noise.
I am really old because this music sounds like shit. I turned into Stan from South Park where everything just sounds like shit.
Say, can you all turn down the music a little bit, please? I'm trying to order a drink and I can't hear the bartender.
They wander the club as Ethan is having a hard time communicating, but they follow a closed door to a Kubrickian type bathroom. Now, this scene was in the trailers, the famous load up the fist scene that I talked about earlier, where Cavill cocks his arms before fighting. I have trouble believing that these are the only people in this bathroom, with the exception of two dudes who, for some reason, make a gay joke. However, I do find this to be a great scene. I love the absence of music, and this raw type energy is something the franchise has been lacking. If anything, I love McQuarrie's ability to make this scene and the film as a whole stand out. This guy they're fighting, apparently they had a big name actor who they never named in this role. He got weary and didn't do the training, so he got cut out, and they put this guy in who was, by the way, he was Emily Blunt's double in The Edge of Tomorrow, which I guess Cruises works with people, he likes them, and he brings them in. And he was just supposed to be the fight coordinator here, but McQuarrie put him in as the opponent here, and he's fun, man. I like this scene a lot.
This scene is a 10 on 10. Everything that goes on here in the bathroom is, which is funny because normally not, is just fantastic. Now, I don't like the lead up into the club because these bracelets just boggle my mind, and you don't laser scan an RFID bracelet. So I'm rolling my eyes. But as soon as we get in here, and it's just even the anticipation of this dude standing at the sink and he knows they're watching him, and it's just, you got a good 30 seconds of tension and then it just goes. It is shot just badass. The action. I'll give the cinematographer credit for making all three of these people look like they're the same height, because Cavill is 6 foot and nobody else is. It's fucking great. It really is.
Yeah, I feel like everything that's been said about the scene is justified. I'll add, I like that this is one of the few action movies that acknowledges that fights like this tire the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Like, because there's a part where the two of them are just fucking exhausted. Yep. And Walker's just breathes and literally walks into getting kicked in the face.
That's a great point.
Here's the problem, though. If you're Lark / Walker, and the whole plan is to get Ethan to believe that this is the real John Lark, why would you hire someone who's this good of a fighter? It'd be a lot easier if you hired a guy who could barely tie his shoes together.
Point.
I know you got to make it look believable, but I think there was such a thing as a happy medium.
I like that the masks have been an ongoing discussion that we've had since the very first film. I love that they make a joke out of Cavill smashing this dude with the briefcase.
Yep.
And they can't make the mask. It's fucking great.
And you could also read into that as he did that on purpose.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah, given who he's revealed to be. Through all this, it's Ilsa who gets the clean shot on who at this point we believe is John Lark. And this blood on the floor, by the way, was added digitally, which they didn't want to deal with the continuity of the makeup on the floor. Now, Ferguson was 7 months pregnant at the time this stopped filming. She plays an important role, especially towards the end. But considering how much she was involved in last week's film, I think she's kind of wasted here.
So it's not that she's wasted. I just think it's redundant because she serves the same plot function as the wild card. So it feels like a repeated beat rather than a progression. I'm happy to see her, because outside of her, there's no women in this movie outside of Michelle Monaghan for 5 minutes. So I feel like they kind of said, all right, we'll keep the team as the three of them if we bring Ilsa back. But I just don't like that they're having her do the same thing.
Yeah, I appreciate that she's back, because I think she was just a tour de force last film. And I think, you know, when Cruz finds somebody he really likes working with, he's going to find a way to bring him back. Look, in some of these films, Luther's got very little to do, and I feel like they filmed him separately from the rest of the cast. So I don't think they always find a way to integrate everybody great, but I do like that she's back. I'm happy to see her.
Matt, you forgot one other woman we're going to talk about here in a bit. Ilsa.
Oh, yeah, you're right. But like on the IMF team.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Because in the other movies, we had Maggie Q and Paul.
That's a good point.
It's just, you know, the IMF / CIA is a sausage fest. You know, no, it's like no dicks allowed from this point on.
Ilsa says she doesn't understand what Ethan's involved in, and Ethan just leaves. Ilsa says that if Ethan goes through with this, they're going to believe that he's Lark and kill him. She then says that you should have come with me.
I do love that they kind of acknowledge how convoluted this plot is, where he's like, help me understand exactly what I'm involved in.
I agree, yes, because too. At this point, I'm fucking confused. And I gotta say, like I mentioned, I think the first 40 minutes are so dragged. I'm still with it, you know, because of the fight in the bathroom. I'm like picked back up, but I'm not really liking what I'm seeing plot-wise.
And no, I agree. I think it's just it. Yeah, you need to kind of stop and remind us what the stakes are, what's going on, and why we're here. And it has to stop and do it a couple times.
So I do acknowledge that the story as it's presented is a flaw. And certainly this movie is nowhere near as tightly plotted as Rogue Nation is, which I still think from a plot standpoint, that's the best of the series. I give it more of a pass here because of the six movies, this is the first one that is functioning as just a straightforward action movie. And what I mean by that is, if you notice, this movie is kind of like The Road Warrior, except it's twice as long in a lot of ways, almost literally. But it's also one extended chase sequence.
Yep.
If you look, every action set piece is either running to get somebody, running away from somebody, or chasing someone else in a vehicle of some kind. So it's literally one big chase sequence stretched out for 2 hours. But not only do I give it a pass because of this one's much more action focused and you can kind of get away with flimsy writing if your action is good. And that's the point I want to highlight. I think the action in this movie, I'm never bored with any of these sequences, which I was genuinely surprised by for a 2.5 hour movie.
So we cut to the White Widow giving a speech about how she is continuing the tradition of her mom, Max, who I didn't pick up on until this viewing, but this is actually Vanessa Redgrave's character from the first one that she's referencing.
And it's also, I consider this good fan service. When they first said this, I rolled my eyes. But you notice none of her conversations with Ethan, granted she thinks he's Lark. She never mentions her mom's history with a guy named Ethan Hunt. Yep. He never directly references it. It's here. It's a wink and a nod. We're going to move the fuck on.
And by the way, this was a crew suggestion. This wasn't even in the original script.
The first time I didn't recognize it in this film, I don't think it was till I saw the next one that I put two and two together, just because the first time I saw this, everything's going so fast. I think it's good. I like her plenty. I think we're getting a redundant character a little bit in what's going on. Is she good? Is she bad? I mean, she's a bad person. Even by the end of this, I'm sorry, there's no redeeming when she's, the whole just a broker thing is kind of bullshit, but I like her, but she's almost just a device to get where we got to go.
Now, Matt, you and I reviewed this Vanessa Kirby when we did Hobbs and Shaw.
Oh, that's right.
I want to say the same thing about her here that I said then. I find her to be a lovely actress who just lacks presence. This is a highly unbelievable bit of casting that I just never get on board with.
I think she's fine. She's here for sex appeal. But my problem is you call her the White Widow, which is already annoying because Black Widow is a very common term.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at her, I'm like, how did none of you fucking idiots cast her as Emma Frost, the White Queen? Because she would have been far better than fucking January Jones.
We'll talk about it. I probably have issues with what you just said.
I think she's fine. I like Vanessa Kirby when she's a little more full-figured and her name is Hannah Waddingham, because if you look, they're the exact same fucking person. Same face, same everything, but body structure. She's fine, but and this is something I'm worried about in a month when I go see her in another movie. I just don't think she's got star power. I think she's there because she's got a specific facial bone structure, and she's got the most beautiful eyes that aren't Alexandra Daddario's. And other than that, I just don't see a lot of appeal.
Well, I just think she doesn't work as well in modern movies as she does in period pieces.
Yes.
Yeah,
because I think Crown. She was very good in The Crown. Mm-hmm. She was one of the only things I liked in Napoleon. But I think she pulls that type of stuff off very well. But I just don't think she's been given the right roles in conventional Hollywood.
She always looks surprised. She always looks like a kid that just stuck a fork in an outlet. I mean, you're the White Widow. You know, Vanessa Redgrave looked in control. This chick just looks like, oh my God, I can't believe what's happening.
The exception is Pieces of a Woman. She's really good in that. But that movie's so fucking depressing, I never want to watch it again.
Yeah, that's a really depressing film. So Ethan meets White Widow at the bar, and she already figures out that he's not John Lark. Ethan's approached by her security as he says that her life is in danger. They look around.
Aren't you a little short for a terrorist?
They look around the room, and he asks if the people in that room are there for him or her, and if she's willing to take that chance. Ethan then gets in a bar fight as she pulls out a blade and joins in on the fun, as does Ilsa. So we see Ethan and the White Widow. They're in a car as they pull up to a massive house. They make their way out to a map where there's a plan to extract Solomon Lane from capture. Ethan goes over who Lane actually is, and the White Widow reveals herself to just be the broker. And the plan is, if they can extract Lane, he'll receive the plutonium. So we cut to what we think is the motorcade containing Lane, and McQuarrie shoots this in an almost montage style with somber music playing in the background, and it was revealed to be the plan to kill everyone. And Matt, yet another, it's not necessarily a dream sequence, but did we really need like this outlook of what could happen?
No, I don't think we need the literalization of his questionable like morality. Because it's just a weird jump for franchise six movies in to start doing dream sequences and be much more metaphorical.
Ethan told if he wants the plutonium, then this is the price. We then cut to Walker talking to Sloan about the plan, and Erica is none too pleased. We see Walker suggest that Hunt is John Lark. He says that Hunt has paid a guy to play the part of Lark and had him killed in the guise of saving his own country. He says, why would Lane turn on his country? And how long would a guy like Hunt have enough of being disavowed until he turns on his own? And he gives Sloan the phone that he says they pulled from the body, but the phone that they pulled from the body was actually dirty. So what this phone is, I have no idea. Yet more complications of this plot.
To a degree, but his rationale, if you're trying to convince somebody, makes all the sense in the world. So that's why I don't think it's bad writing. But the question she should ask is, okay, he's been disavowed five straight movies for all intents and purposes. What made him break finally?
Yeah, I think that's what we need to see, a point of what would do it. Even if somebody just referenced his wife a little better, I don't think anybody's ever convinced of his tipping point. If it's supposed to fool somebody, it sure as hell is never designed to fool the audience. And if you're not going to fool the audience, there's no reason to have it try to fool someone in your movie.
No, it's just him. This is the most blatant thing of, oh, he's the bad guy because he gives her the unbroken phone.
Mm-hmm.
I also love how it's in Paris, and I'm thinking of the freaking cinematography in this. It reminds me of like the John Wick sequels with the way they're framed of two people staring at each other, and there's a far shot, and the person just leaves with a historic landmark in the background.
We cut to Lane being taken via helicopter to his motorcade, and boys, we said this last week, but they brought this Solomon Lane, they brought him back for this. He's the first villain to be brought back for two straight Mission Impossible movies. We're going to find out that it's actually Cavill who's the villain, but Matt, was it necessary to bring Solomon Lane back?
Yes, because you've built the movie around the consequences of him being captured. So it would have been weird if he was in prison for the whole movie and you just don't see him, because I don't want that stupid knock off Hannibal Lecter scene where they go to talk to him. I think that's equally lazy. But also, I like that we have a villain. We're fully exploring like a villain being in cahoots with someone else. They tried that in the first one, but that twist comes so late that they don't have any time to explore like him and Jean Reno being together. And they tried it with the third one, but that was just a disaster because you undermined Hoffman entirely. I like that here it's sort of, what if Blofeld and 006 teamed up? Where it's like you have like, it's not just a villain and a henchman, they're on like an equal playing field. And it's sort of like a mutual partnership on philosophy and ultimately convenience. But also I like that Lark is fucking pissed at him. Like, we finally have the thing of the villain saying, why don't we just kill him?
Exactly.
Because he keeps telling him that constantly. He's like, why all this revenge bullshit? Mm-hmm. They very rarely do that in movies.
Yeah, I need Lane here because he was my favorite villain. He still gives me what I am pissed at the last couple Bond movies for. So damn right I want him back.
They pull Lane out as Walker asks about him, and Hunt stops him and says, whatever you've heard about Lane, if it makes your skin crawl, it's true. We see a truck topple over as Hunt and Walker prepare themselves, and this motorcade and extraction of Lane is the turning point of the movie for me, boys. Up until now, I've been enjoying what I've seen, but I haven't really been that engaged, as I've mentioned. But from this point on, this movie doesn't stop, and it is a treat. But I'll admit, this first 50 minutes or so had me checking my watch.
I think this, like, the action beats in this movie are tremendous, but I have to say, this is the worst example of trying to chase the Dark Knight. It's literally the Harvey Dent transportation sequence.
Mm.
It's at the same point in the movie, you have the guy in the armored car that they have to get out, and in both movies, a fucking armored car gets knocked into the goddamn river.
I love the action in this movie for the most part. I'm not big on this breakout. I don't know what it is. It just doesn't engage me very much. Maybe it's because they do the trick of, you know, showing it just to reshow it. Is he going to do the deed as Lark or is he going to do it as Ethan? It's fine. I don't know. There's something about car breakouts. I don't find them as kinetic as they think they are.
Guy who watched Heat and said, you amateurs.
I think it's because
I saw it in the movies with Adam, and I think that is what he said.
I think they go on a little too long as well, and I think that's part of it.
So the SWAT truck goes in the water and Lane is pulled out.
I love the practicalities of this. Mm-hmm. Like, there are shots in this I think are tremendous. Watching it sink into the CN and watching it turn and fill up with water, fucking glorious shot. And that this is done practically, mwah, chef's kiss.
It's also, they do some good stuff with the editing and the lighting where it cuts and you see the inside of the car where they're cutting through it with the laser. Mm-hmm. And all you see is just the red start to infiltrate the screen. And you also, at this point, don't know if Benji and Luther are actually helping with this. So the fact that they're here and involved is a surprise.
And I like the fact that we're seeing this tracker being put on him, but we're not sure exactly what it is. You know, we'll find that out later. There's some really good stuff going on here.
I also don't like that you have Simon Pegg in a movie and Sean Harris with that beard looks eerily similar to Simon Pegg.
It is really, really weird.
Like, I thought the big twist was going to be their brothers.
That would have been a twist.
Let Benji be just a plant this entire time.
Well, I thought the big reveal was that John Lark was going to be Jeremy Renner. My brain's like, if that happens, I'm walking out of the theater.
Didn't you say you had heard, though, that Renner wasn't in this? So why would you think
that? Yeah, but I thought that was also them, like, keeping face. I thought it was a swerve.
I'll go ahead and say it now, since Matt just put that there. I thought it was going to be Baldwin.
Yeah, that was where my mind went, too.
See, I wouldn't have liked that, though, because it would have been, like, the third movie where the mentor or...
And that's why I thought.
That's why I would. I'm not saying I would have agreed with it, but I did think that's where he was going.
Or it would have been Joan Lark and it's Angela Bassett.
Ethan Walker, they get stuck in an alley as they leave and Hunt gets on a motorcycle. Hunt makes contact with Benji and Luther as Ethan scurries on his motorcycle. Just an awesome chase here as Ethan is causing the perfect distraction to get Lane out. And I hate rotating shots usually, but this shot of when Hunt stops and McCrory's just rotating the camera around so we're seeing that nobody's around him. That is when I do like a rotating shot, is when it actually has a purpose.
I also like how this takes place finally in the real world as far as side streets and alleys are not big enough to support cars driving through them all the fucking time. They literally get stuck. Yeah. And there's actual cars that they have to drive by. Mm-hmm. It's not an empty street. They're actually putting thought into the other obstacles you have to overcome. The only thing they should have thought of was that Ethan Hunt cannot be hit by a car, ejected off his bike, fly 30 feet, and just roll on the ground and be fine with no helmet.
It's a huge crash. He's rolling. This shot's in the trailer, too. And he looks, and I'm like, wow, is he going to be hurt? Nope. He gets right back up.
Yeah, that was the moment equivalency of Vin Diesel catching Michelle Rodriguez in midair in Fast 6 while jumping off the fucking highway. We're like, okay, I guess we're in a world where these people are made of rubber. And I thought this franchise was better than that. I'm not going to knock the movie a point for it, but it's the most notable example up to this point of clashing and getting a little bit too close to superhero-dom.
I will say, though, he does get up limping, but I think that's only because of a shot from later on in the film.
I'll say it looks amazing. It looks tremendous, and I love that it stops on a dime, literally because of him hitting that car. This isn't how chases end. It's pretty fucking great.
So Ethan jumps in a well where Luther and Benji have Lane on a boat. We see Hunt bring Lane out to a completely green female cop who tries to make a name for herself by pulling a gun. Ethan tells her to walk away before she's shot by goons. Ethan takes them down and attends to the cop. He tells her that she's going to be okay as Benji says that they have to go. And of course, this is when Elsa pulls up on a bike. She aims a gun and shoots at their car as Ethan tells them to get out. Lane is in the front seat as they're being pursued again. And again, McQuarrie, the score of this is pretty good. It does have hints of Dark Knight, as I mentioned. It is an underling of Hans Zimmer who did this. But for this scene, no music. I thought that was an interesting choice. I thought that was a good choice.
This feels like what Ben Burtt gets for each of the Star Wars films.
Yeah, you know, that
it's just, I was confused. I want to say the first like three times that I watched this film, because I've seen it a few times. How was Elsa shooting this car? Lane is dead, right? Like she shoots him dead center head, but nobody's hit. And then I realized that it's their, you know, it's their getaway car that they had stashed. So I'm assuming this windshield is bulletproof. I don't know. But Elsa shoots with a sniper rifle, Lane just dead center of the head through that windshield. But he's not hit at all.
And I just thought it just hit the glass and stopped.
Yeah. And that's,
I never saw penetration or bleeding right
there. Yeah. And that's the first couple times I'm like, this makes no sense. And it pissed me off. And it wasn't until later I realized this is their high-tech getaway car. So that windshield would be reinforced.
So they're shot at as Ethan gets in traffic. He then pulls the brake as he glides down some steps. The chase continues until Ethan sees Elsa through her mask, and he drives through her as she shoots at Lane. I love.
She stays on the ground longer than he did.
I know.
And she was wearing a goddamn helmet.
I don't like Lane in this movie, but I do like this line he says where he's like, that was Elsa. Ethan just tells him to shut up.
That is the first thing he says.
Yes.
I love that the entire time in this car, he's sitting there not saying a word.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're getting shot at. His head flinches a little bit. They're bouncing off walls and going downstairs. He is silent. His mouth isn't taped shut. And there's nothing he says until Ilsa. Fucking love it.
Well, that's also a consistency that they've established where he's been ping-ponged around various government agencies but hasn't said a word.
Yeah.
Like they can't interrogate him.
Lane is brought right before Luther and Benji as Benji injects him with some dopamine and says that this won't hurt enough. Another good line there. Lane gives some monologues as he calls Benji his funny little friend. He says that the Syndicate was civilization's last hope and that Ethan should have killed him as everything he feared is now coming, which is the fallout of all his good intentions. Benji sends a drone as Ethan tells Lane that you're mine now. Hunt meets with the White Widow and says that he doesn't trust her people, and she responds with, family, what can you do?
Now we're really going to do Fast and Furious with all the family talk.
I thought of that too.
Not just because she's in one of them.
Yeah. And I never think about that dumb franchise. The White Widow asks about the woman who tried killing her and Lane, and Ethan says that they have a complicated past. White Widow says that if Hunt doesn't bring her Ilsa, then the plutonium will go to the highest bidder. Why does she want Ilsa?
Good question. So I'll say Tom Cruise's answer about complicated relationships with women is the answer to every time that he sits and has one of his meetings.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm surprised Matt Lauer wasn't here.
The White Widow then weirdly kisses Ethan here. We then cut to Ilsa, who heard the whole meeting. She catches up to Ethan and she says that she knows he has his reasons, and he tells her to walk away. She says that she's there to protect Lark and killed him to protect Lark, and her reason for being there is to kill Lane. She says that MI6 sent her to kill Lane, and she has to prove her loyalty by doing so. She says that she needs to kill him or she'll never stop running. Ethan won't give up his location, and Ilsa says that she will get to Lane one way or another and begs Ethan not to make her go through him.
All she has to do is step over him.
That's more drama of Julia being affiliated with Lane as Ethan wakes up to a call from the White Widow asking him if he wants to meet the courier. We cut to Ethan going before Alan, who says that he was hoping it wasn't true, and asks what happened. Ethan tells Alan his plan, and I love that Benji is surprised at the idea of being Lane. He's like, when did this happen?
I love Luther's response that he looks at him. He's like, hey, points at his arm.
Walker speaks up and tells Ethan to not let the apostles take the plutonium again. And I love how when Benji asks how Ethan plans on not letting Benji get killed, Ethan responds with, I'm working on it.
It's what they said right in the script.
No shit. Alan says that a trail of evidence connects Hunt to the theft of smallpox, and a history of rogue behavior says that Ethan has snapped and is in fact Lark himself. And I love this performance by Baldwin, as Alan knows this whole thing is a ruse, but he's playing chess in this speech, which pretty much incriminates Hunt as being exactly who Walker says he is. This is good stuff by Baldwin.
This scene is a little too much.
Like a little too long, or just a little too much story-wise?
It's weaving threads that it wants to trick you, and in doing so, it convolutes something that doesn't need to be. This thing has been more of an action piece than a spy mystery, and this is just trying to inject some stuff a little too slick.
I will agree that there are a few too many backstabbings in this next 10 minutes or so, but I do love this moment because we believe that given Alan's bad vibes with Hunt last film, he believes what he's saying, but he knows what's going on, as we'll find out.
It's not that there's too many swerves. I just think that the movie has to keep reminding, it's almost like it keeps injecting itself with adrenaline that, hey, it's a Mission Impossible movie. You got to have a double cross or some kind of like espionage. And they kind of feel like insert scenes to keep the plot moving. Because the movie's, up to this point, largely been functioning just on the strength of the action and characters interacting with each other, not necessarily the plot evolving. And up to this point, I'm fully with it. I got past the questionable, like, murky waters of the setup, but I'm fully on board at this point, and I'm not going to say this makes the movie slow down, but when did they have time to rehearse this?
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Because they clearly, like, this movie functions very much so that not a lot of time is passing, like, and there's no time to waste. When did they get in contact with Huntley and say, hey, we need you to show up unannounced and play this theater act, basically?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We see Alan get injected with something, and Ethan tells Luther to trust him. And then we see Walker equip himself as he goes to Lane, who says that he's not done with Hunt yet. And here's when we get our first F word of the series.
But this is such a great line of, why did you have to make this so fucking complicated?
I agree.
He should be like, I'm about to ask you the same thing.
Yeah.
I do. Every now and then I do feel like they make these jokes and they're completely self-aware, and that's how this feels. But if you're going to give it to someone, Cavill punctuating that fucking with the mustache and the zoom in on his face just is fucking great.
Walker says that the old war order needs retooling. He tells Lane that Hunt is the only friend he has, as his unwillingness to kill him is why he's alive today. And this is when Benji, bum bum bum, takes the Lane mask off, and Alan is there to say, "We were doing so well until now. I did think this was a good reveal."
I think this was fantastic. This is great stuff.
And the exclamation point is when Alan says, "I can see why you guys enjoy this so much."
But if I'm pulling the gun, you know, and doing that click click, you were doing so well up until now.
No, I like this, that they're one step ahead, because it gets past the thing of, okay, why would Walker keep the camera up if he was going to do this? So it's like, but the movie's also established he's very overconfident throughout. He is the Kool-Aid man in this movie, where he just busts through walls.
Literally.
Breaks shit and just leaves, oftentimes in worse condition when they found it. But it also has to make sense for Benji playing Lark, or Lane. We got a Lane and a Lark as the two villains, for God's sake. This is ridiculous. Him not saying a whole lot until he's like probed, that has to track, which is why I think he doesn't, again, not just because of the chronology, but to make this scene actually be convincing.
You guys mentioned the overconfidence of Lark here. I have to say, as much as I'm not a fan of Cavill in this character, he is more suited for this than Superman, because Cavill does have an overconfidence quality to him, almost like an arrogance. And I'm not saying that as a person, I'm saying as an actor. And so he personifies that much better here than he would as a superhero such as Superman. Now, we mentioned those movies aren't exactly the best written movies and wasn't exactly a good representation of that character, but I do think that Cavill's better suited for this character as opposed to Superman.
This Man from U.N.C.L.E., Witcher, has some roles that are made just perfect for him. I like him as Superman, though he's not a great Superman, and he's really not a good Clark Kent. This, perfect. I mean, this is right up his wheelhouse. And I think I've said it for like the third time during this discussion. If nobody's seen The Man from U.N.C.L.E., go fucking watch it. It's a blast.
Yeah, that one's it's a good time. And I don't blame him for how Superman ended. Like, almost none of my problems with those movies, as we talked about, I place at Cavill's feet. No. But at the same time, I think it shows that there were other roles. Like, if he played someone that was more morally questionable or just an outright villain, maybe it would have worked. You know, I'm thinking of characters like Lobo. I think he would have been good as. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I was even thinking Deathstroke to a certain degree. He's a little bit younger than he's typically portrayed, but I think someone like that, where he's got a confidence about him. Hell, he probably would have been a really good Deadshot in Suicide Squad if the movie was actually tooled properly.
Yeah.
But I also, this proves to me he never would have been a good Bond, in the sense that he doesn't have that type of, I don't want to call it suaveness, but he doesn't have that kind of, that real charm that Bond has to pull out as his last resort. I just think Cavill, between his build and his line delivery, because I don't think he's a great actor. That's the thing. It's not a Daniel Craig situation where I think he's an amazing actor, but they didn't always write his Bond particularly well. I just don't think Cavill, even with the best of scripts, could have pulled it off.
He doesn't come off as a ladies' man to me.
He does it something like The Witcher, but that's also fantasy.
Jen loves that series, and after watching the first season, I'm like, oh, I wonder why.
Yeah, I'm going to say that thing played in my house oftentimes on pause.
Ethan calls Walker Lark, and Erica is there to say that she doesn't appreciate being used. She says that she'll come to them as CIA agents come in, and Erica says that she's bringing them all in. And this is when another ruse is revealed, and the agents open fire on them. Walker.
Yeah, we're getting swerves on top of swerves.
It's insane. I could not believe it. We talked about it, Matt, when we reviewed this the first time, but we came out of that theater. You know, we both of us really raved about it when we saw it in those years ago, but I had completely forgotten just how many fucking swerves, bro, we get here.
There's double crosses on top of double crosses. This movie is basically sort of operating on Pirates 3 logic, where anyone can turn on anybody at any time.
Walker gets into it with Alan and then kills him. I actually like Baldwin in these. As I mentioned, I hated seeing him go.
Well, I was like, okay, if somebody's going to die, he's the most expendable.
Exactly.
But they also, they foreshadow the knife, because that's the first thing he pulls out of
that suitcase,
which I like, because look, everybody needs a gimmick, and he can't kill people with a mustache. It would have been cool if they did like Bond, where instead of a hat, he can rip off the mustache. Like it's a fake one, but it's like a razor sharp batarang that he can just throw at people.
Got a garrote hitting inside it.
The fight wages on as Mark makes his way out. We see Luther fire a few times. I wasn't expecting this, as Ethan discovers Alan and he dies right in front of him. Luther tells Ethan to get that son of a bitch and leaves. And here's where we get our Bigfoot chase. Benji is again following him, and when Cruz breaks his ankle, it is a painful scene to watch. You notice it when it happens, and it's a split second, but my God, like, I had to turn away from it. It's like watching fucking Theismann get his leg broken by Lawrence Taylor. It's just,
it's not that bad, because there's no bone marrow spilling out onto the camera.
True, but still, it's painful to see. And how this guy was able to recover from this at his age, what, 7-8 weeks later, is insane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also surprised he had enough humility to keep this take in the movie.
Yeah, me too. You'd think he would have had the vanity to just kind of say, no, keep it out. But yeah, he was the one who encouraged McCrory to leave it in.
But I also like that they're kind of harkening back to the third one where Benji has to guide him.
Yeah, I always love Benji being Ethan's GPS.
But the tech, like, he had it in like 3D mode for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like they do a good job of intercutting some comedy in this. Like, it's not... The trailer makes you think this is going to be a lot more dour than it actually is.
True.
This doesn't have the Dark Knight Rises problem where I think the jokes are really, the one-liners are really forced, like the, that's what that feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the breaks are there just kind of perfectly done, you know, to add into it. And yeah, to your point, his thing with this pad, just like, oh, sorry, I didn't have the screen swerve on, or I had it in 2D mode. It's just, you're fucking laughing because we've all done it. Why isn't my phone rotating?
Yeah.
Like, damn, I don't have the auto rotate. I'm jumping out a window.
And this woman on the headphones, like, being just completely oblivious to everything around her as Ethan's going past. This is pretty fun stuff. So Ethan's going through the building, and Benji, he's having, as you guys mentioned, the screen lock on. Ethan's hesitating to jump out a window, and Benji asks, what are you doing? Which is great. He gets to the elevator where Lark is standing over him. He points a gun and says that he still has plans for him. He tells Ethan to turn himself in and reveal himself to be Lark. And if Ethan says anything, Julia dies. So the snot thickens yet again.
I didn't like the notion of they're going to have Michelle Monaghan be tied up again in one of these movies. You bring her back just to be the hostage again. I was terrified of where this was, where I thought it was going to lead.
Yeah, that kind of caught me off guard. But it's also the point where your villain has your hero dead to rights, gun in his face, and then, I can't kill you. Of course not. I mean,
yeah.
You know, to another movie we've ripped on a couple times, you won't let me live. You won't let me die. I mean, just that trope is a little overplayed. This series has been smarter than that.
Ethan pulls
at the very least, though, he's already said, all right, I'm pissed that Lane won't let me kill you.
Yeah, I like that.
Ethan pulls himself up to the top of the building as the helicopter takes off, and we're hearing that any attempt to defuse one nuclear bomb triggers the other. Their solution is still being worked on, but this is technically a suicide mission. And Matt, I don't know about you, but I thought for sure they would kill Ethan here.
I thought they would have killed somebody.
Luther says in all the years he's known Ethan, he's only been serious about two women, and this is when he tells Elsa about Julia. And I like that we finally get an explanation as to why Julia isn't with Ethan anymore. Luther says
that... Elsa's like, who? Who's the other woman? Well, Tandy Newton was around.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, wait, no.
Luther says that every now and then, Julia sends a signal that she's okay, and the only reason they are in this mess is because Ethan wouldn't let him die, and if Ilsa cares about Ethan, she'd walk away.
He should have said, I left you all the clues, and left a picture of a snow, left her a picture of a snowman.
This is when it's revealed that they actually put a transponder in Lane's neck, and he's going to lead them to the plutonium. We hear that Lane is airborne, and they'll have to go it alone to get him. We move on to Kashmir, as Ethan tells Benji he knows he's going to figure out how to defuse the bombs. And we find out that Lane's last detected spot is at a medical camp, which means that he was responsible for the smallpox outbreak. Benji says that there's a flaw in the bomb's operating system, and that the detonator has a fire key that, if removed, will short it out.
Why is it that every movie, when there's these big, like, objects of destruction, there's a built-in failsafe that the villains don't know about?
I know. Geez, fucking Galen Erso built these nuclear weapons.
No, that's basically what it is. It's the Death Star thing of, well, yeah, it is this all-powerful thing, except for this one little thing we just couldn't resolve.
Let's just remember, this is our fucking multiple times we're dealing with nuclear bombs the same way.
Benji says, in order to make the detonator work, it can't be removed until the countdown actually begins. We're just adding complication upon complication here.
Yeah, we made this shit a little too... This is just multiple levels of complexity because someone thinks it's smart, but it takes some of the just no.
I just think it's literally the nuclear option of screenwriting, where it's, well, we can't come up with a climax, so we're just going to have a bomb and a countdown.
Yeah. Like, literally like, a ticking clock.
I'm so sick of this trope. I mean, as great as this movie is, I wish they came up with something stronger for the resolution.
We see Lane put the plutonium in place. Meanwhile, Ethan's team is also in place as Ethan scouts the area, but his plans are thwarted by Julia making an appearance. We then meet her husband, Eric, who might as well be played by James Marsden, because Jesus Christ, is this guy a fucking vulnerable pushover? Wes Bentley. Wow.
So it's funny, Laura was sitting next to me during my rewatch for the last part of this here in Kashmir, and she was convinced this guy was a villain because it's fucking Wes Bentley.
Yeah.
Talk about a random person to throw in who's never not a villain.
Well, when you have jet black hair and a pale complexion like that,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to get a lot of leading man roles.
Yeah.
Especially when you you invested in some powdery substances like he did back in the day.
Absolutely. Ethan says they used to work together, as Eric tells of their guardian angel who called and saved their field hospital, who donated and saved it as long as he could run it. And I love how Cruz is, he's doing his massive run even when he's leaving this scene. The guy's never fucking doing that karate chopping of the air.
It's also important to note they got around the thing of her literally being held hostage.
Yep.
They actually contrived a way for her to be here without it coming across as too convenient.
Good point.
If you remember in the third one, she's a doctor, medical practitioner. It makes sense that she would pursue that further and would sort of be Doctors Without Borders. And of course, now that the villains, if they know his wife, they'd find a way to pose as a front because they're very good at putting up fake personas.
Mm-hmm.
So Luther and Benji, they get the bomb out as Luther is put to task. The countdown starts, so now it's go time. Ethan, Benji, and Ilsa, they get in a car, and Ethan says that he's going to get the detonator. So what's he do? He jumps on a goddamn helicopter. Another crazy stunt of him holding this rope and then falling to the net holding the payload. My God, I mean, this is crazy.
He's got to keep up on himself. Helicopter action to me is a little, it's a step down a little bit. But when it's shot huge and on a big screen, damn. But I don't know. Helicopters chasing each other never get my goat.
You know what? You took one of my lines from later on, because I was never a fan of Airwolf, Adam. Remember that show? Way back.
Oh, you bite your tongue. That's the exception there.
I hated that show as a kid. So I'm watching this. I'm the same as you, man. I'm not a fan of this helicopter stuff. But once they land, once they crash, it actually turns into pretty good stuff. But yeah, I'm not with this helicopter stuff either.
Oh, I'm on board for this, because they might, if this was medieval times, they'd be using fucking dragons with this dogfight, and they're really making use of the IMAX format and the aspect changes. Like, this is, I think, one of the most justifiable instances of doing it, because, I mean, this shit's a wonder to behold, and the last 20 minutes of this movie, I'm literally clenching my seat, genuinely curious about what's going to happen and feeling tension. And it's one of the only times where I feel like the countdown that they keep reflecting actually feels like it's moving at the pace of the movie itself.
Agreed. Yep.
So you think as Ethan's climbing up this thing, it's gripping stuff? This,
I would say, yeah.
Gripping as Ethan grips. Never mind.
No, I'm not even going to dignify that.
So Ethan throws someone out of the helicopter as he takes control of it, as everyone wonders how Ethan is in a helicopter. I have to say, man, with the exception of Ethan throwing the guy out, because of course they're not going to do that, I thought for sure in watching this, again, I thought it was all green screen work. Nope, this is all practical. Cruz learned how to fly this fucking thing for this scene, and fuck.
And not only that, but watching press for current movies, if he likes you enough, he will give you a ride home from set to save you hour to 2 hours of driving for your valet. And he will do that in his personal helicopter.
Jesus.
You know where somewhere sitting in an old rocket chair is Harrison Ford going, oh, you fucking bitch.
Till you crash it, you're not a real actor.
Find a golf course. Ethan continues pursuing Lark as Ilsa says that she likes Julia. Ethan unloads the payload into the water as Lark grabs a gun and fires at him. Ethan's copter spins out of control as the firing continues. Ilsa heads to the village and Benji joins her. Luther starts cutting wires as Julia asks how Ethan is, and Luther just says, you know, same old Ethan, as he's still up in the air with Lark. Benji finds one of the bombs as Ilsa finds the last bomb and then gets into it with Lane. Ethan, meanwhile, he pulls some moves and pursues Lark as we cut to Ilsa being tied up by Lane. Benji fights with him and Lane beats his ass and hangs him. I have to be honest, guys, I thought for sure they would kill him here.
Once again, though, we have a movie where we have a man punching a woman in the face and nobody questioned, like,
Yeah.
Nobody questions it. Like, it doesn't feel gross or mean-spirited.
Yeah, I think they were going to have this be the White Widow, but Quarry did say that he's never been a fan of catfights in movies, and he thought it might be a distraction to have two chicks go at it. But it's not a distraction to have a dude just punch her right in the face, I guess.
I think it's so earned that I like it, you know, and Ferguson just seems up to the match. It fits. It really does. I also got to say, I love Julia showing back up. You know, there's a moment that's played earlier when they ask if Ethan's here on vacation. He says, no work. And the face acting that Moynihan brings, where she's like, oh shit, if he's there for work, she knows what that means. So to have her show up here with Luther, and that she's not going to run because where's she going to go? Mm-hmm. And that she's going to participate. I really like that they give her something to do here after bringing her back in. And it's done in a way that is pretty fucking fulfilling.
Don't forget, too, that Ferguson's pregnant here. So she's doing all these scenes while pregnant.
Whoa, I know. We're very thankful to everybody for their gifts.
Ilsa breaks the chair to get out of it as Benji tries standing on a box to prevent himself from suffocating. This stuff was painful for me to watch, boys. Goddamn.
It did make me think of the Black Widow breakout from the first Avengers film. You know, when she breaks the chair and then she's having that fight. It took me back to that choreography.
Ethan then rams Lark's helicopter and they crash. And this is the stuff that I liked once they finally get on the ground with these helicopters. I should say on this mountaintop.
Oh, this shit's insane. Where they crash the helicopters into each other. I don't know what Cavill says, but he has a line that cracks me up where he's like, just die already or something.
Yes. Yeah, that is a good line.
And he gets like fucking burned by a laser. Like, it's literally the end of Wrath of Khan when the villain gets their face burned off partially.
You do it just for the last 5 minutes of this. And then you when this first happened, of course he's going to come back and now he's going to be a scarred villain for the next film. Nope.
That's what I thought. I thought he was going to get away or just be like, fuck this, I'll get you next time, Gadget.
Ilsa does her head scissors move on Lane, but she sees Benji losing consciousness and decides to cut him free instead. Lark's helicopter tumbles to Ethan's and hits it, and they go off a cliff. Ethan is sprayed with oil, which I thought was a funny little scene. Like, he's just looking and this oil just spraying him right in the fucking face. And then he falls to Lark, who has a great line here. Why don't you just die, as Matt just mentioned. The other helicopter goes over the cliff as Luther tells Julia to go be with your husband. Benji gets orders from Luther to cut the red wire, Lethal Weapon 3 style. Meanwhile, Lark looks like Two-Face as him and Ethan go at it. The helicopter's falling around and ticking down. They fall off the cliff and hang Temple of Doom style. And I love how this hook just completely takes Lark out.
Oh, this is the one that was... This is like Emilio getting stabbed.
Yeah, I thought of that. Yeah,
good call. Like, he takes a fucking hook
impaled
to the end. And then you see him hit the rocks in the ground and then the helicopter explodes. Like, it's almost like they go out of the way to say he's not coming back.
Yeah, there's no way he's coming back. Luther tells Benji to cut the green wire when ready, and then Luther says that he has complete confidence in Ethan to get the detonator in time. They cut the wire out at one, as we see that Ethan did indeed do it. And I like how, like, we cut to this flash and we think it's actually a nuclear bomb flash, but no, it's just the sun getting in the lens. That was a nicely done shot. Luther just grabs the diffused bombs and says, "My man," as Ethan collapses on a cliff. And I think this guy deserves a nap at this point.
I thought he was going to die from exhaustion.
We cut to the gang wheeling Ethan through a hospital. Oh, we think it's a hospital, but it's actually just a little medical bay.
This fucking Return of the King ending.
As the screen turns to white, we cut to him waking up to Julia and Eric says, "Ethan's a lucky man." Julia asks for a few
three-way
minutes. Julia asks for a few minutes as Eric tells Dr. Thornton, a.k.a. Ethan, goodbye. And Ethan tells Julia that he's sorry for everything. And Matt, you make fun of this, but I love the speech that Julia gives about how everything that happened while they were together led her to her current life. I like these lines a lot. This is probably my favorite part of the film. I love this.
I like that there's no regret. Usually you get this. She's not going to leave Wes Bentley to go be with Tom Cruise. It's a nice ending for everybody. Now, is it smalty? Yeah, because everybody wins. This is the Fast and Furious. We're all family and nobody's going to die in the end. People are going to come back from falling off of airplanes and getting blown up. You know, it's very much in that realm. But I think it fits because I think Cruise has built this into a family. So I think this is as meta as it is for the movie.
And I know Matt hates it.
Well, there's certainly a bit of self-reflection. I just think it's, in the context of this movie, I think it's too schmaltzy.
Wow, I didn't think
but
that.
if I'm reading this as like the conclusion to everything, I can at least justify it internally.
Mm-hmm. Sloan says that she understands why Alan believed in Ethan and that the IMF is indeed needed. Benji asks how close they were, and Ethan replies with the usual, as he says another one of my favorite lines of this movie, "Please don't make me laugh," as credits roll on Mission Impossible Fallout. All right, scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Mission Impossible Fallout? Adam, go ahead, sir.
This was a mission that I think everybody felt they needed to accept in the summer when this movie came out. This thing was everywhere. And I think Fallout feels like a conclusion to the MI series that we've had so far. This is what, number 6? I mean, that's a massive amount of movies for one franchise, especially one that almost ended after 2. And I think they keep getting better consistently. And that's a testament to this franchise. That's a testament to Cruise. That's a testament to the production team, to the directing, to everybody involved in the stunt work, because that's kind of what this series now is based around. I think everybody is firing at the top of their games in this. I think Cavill getting brought in as the antagonist is a brilliant move because of what he was with Superman, because of what he almost was in so many other franchises. And I mean, come on, the dude is just the poster child for fucking fantasies across the board. So to slap an ugly mustache on him and put him in here as well, is as villainous as it gets. To bring back everybody on the team, except for, as we mentioned, poor Hawkeye, who's nowhere to be found. I like the additions that we get, a little bit more for Baldwin to do. Vanessa Kirby is fun in a little role. I don't need more of her than what she is in this. The plot, yeah, it's a little convoluted, but you're not here for the plot in a Mission Impossible movie. You know, there's going to be something that's going to end the world and the MIT needs to stop it. And that's what they do. Harris is a blast to have back. I don't know. Sean Harris, I wish he was around more. I know he's not in the future, but fuck, he is such a worthy adversary, finally, in this franchise. This is one where I feel like they kind of, I think all the other films, you needed to be a fan of Mission Impossible or spy movies or Tom Cruise in general. I think this is the most mass appeal. I think this is the most summer blockbustery of all of them. And I think this one just really hits across the board. This is that four quadrant type of film. And you could watch it by itself. Yes, it's a sequel, but I think you could just put this on and say everything you need to understand is in this film. I think it works that well. There's issues. I think we get an action scene too many. I think we're a little too long. I think that it's a little convoluted, but I also think it's, at this point, just exactly what needed to be done for this franchise. It is a solid 8 on 10. I can't go higher. I want to go 9, but I can't, because rewatching it, it doesn't hold up quite as well as every time before. Like, it's just a little lesser. And if you're going to detract, I'm going to give you that in my score. But this thing is fucking fantastic. 8 on 10 for Fallout. If you haven't seen it, what the hell's the matter with you? I think if you're listening to this, everybody's got to agree. This thing is fucking fantastic.
All right. 8 from Adam. Goudreau, as somebody who I know watched this repeatedly during the pandemic and since, what do you give Mission Impossible Fallout?
Yeah, I did. And my opinion is still pretty consistent that I think it's a great movie, but I actually don't think it's the best Mission Impossible movie up to this. I think Rogue Nation is a tad bit better because I think it encapsulates everything that I would want in a movie of this title. You know, I think it blends the action with the espionage, with actual plot movements better, because that's much more of a pure spy movie. This one's an action movie, and it's a damn good one. And it's consistent throughout, which is a rarity, because normally, even in the best of movies, of action movies, there may be one or two sequences that just don't work or you could do without. That's not the case here. I think everything is so expertly constructed, but I can't call it the best Mission Impossible movie with a script that does cut some corners, and once you roll with it, it never lets you go, but I kind of wish it grabbed me from the start. Maybe if someone died in it at the beginning, as originally intended, or the repetitions of infiltrating being someone else, if that part hadn't already been done before, maybe it would have added a new wrinkle to this franchise, which by this point, in my opinion, has not only resurrected itself, but become a standard bearer franchise for action movies at this point. I think 4, 5, and 6, especially the two McQuarrie films, I think it turned me around and made me a fan of this franchise and eager, if there was going to be another one after this, to see another one. I think everything Adam mentioned about the additions and the returning characters, I agree with wholeheartedly, but I will say I don't think it's as good of a story and a narrative as the last one is. So I'm gonna go just a little bit lower than Rogue Nation, but they're 1A and 1B up to this point. I'm gonna give this a very, very strong 8 on 10.
An 8 from both of my colleagues. You know, one thing I love about doing this podcast is seeing the evolution of series as we cover them. And you go back to number one of this franchise that started way back in 1996, and that movie had a couple action scenes, but it was mostly about the espionage surrounding it. Here we have a bunch of action scenes with some espionage thrown in here and there. The series has become all about the action, all about the stunts, and I gotta say, you know, for the first 40 or so minutes of this movie, I was worried. I'm like, okay, this wasn't as fun as I remembered. I'm not liking the story so far. I think it's, all of us have called it convoluted. I was feeling that. It was in my notes that, is this not as good as I remember? But the scene in the bathroom really did carry that first set of minutes. But after the breakout, I gotta disagree with Adam and say that I think this thing goes and it doesn't stop. I think this thing's fun. I have some issues with the casting of Vanessa Kirby. I don't like her in this movie. But other than that, I think the additions are pretty good. I think Cavill is just, he has a presence, but like I mentioned, I think he needs like another sneer. He needs something that makes me feel like he's the bad guy. By the time he turns on Ethan and that reveal is made, I don't see the character really changing that much. He's shooting at him, but I'm not seeing a bad guy in front of me. I'm just seeing Superman with a mustache. And I just didn't really go with that casting. However, I will say, the final set of minutes of this, the final 30 minutes are super fun. And the movie as a whole, even giving its tough themes, is super fun. So I'm going to go, God, after all the fights that me and Matt got into last year, I hate that we're agreeing this much, but I'm going with an 8 as well. I just had a lot of fun watching this movie. And it's not one I've returned to a lot. I've seen it maybe 2 times since. I've seen Rogue Nation way more, but I think I'm going to watch it more, man. I had a blast with the final hour or so of this movie. It's just a good time. So 8 out of 10 for Mission Impossible Fallout. All right, guys, next week we are going to review a film that we were supposed to end the series on when we first started this site a couple years ago. We're going to go with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. Matt, what was your anticipation leading up to next week's film?
Well, obviously the 5-year delay was disappointing, but there were very extenuating circumstances that the world was experiencing, so I was willing to wait. What scared me, as excited as I was for Macquarie coming back, was the subtitle Part 1. I rebel against that instinctively anytime I see it, because I don't want to see half of a story and have to wait a year or longer to get the other installment. So that gave me concern, and there was one thing I was really excited about that changed with casting that I was disappointed by, that lowered my expectations. But I was still very hyped for it.
All right, Adam, you've been a pretty big fan of this series. What were you expecting with Dead Reckoning next week?
Right in line with Matt. I'm not a fan of the Part 1, so that put me off a little bit, but it made me know that they were, I think, finishing the franchise. That's just what it feels when you do that. I don't know. The time delay, I was excited, but it was tempered a little bit. But you know what? We had Maverick, and Maverick got me as excited for another Mission Impossible movie as anything else. Because fucking that was just a blast. But I'll say my initial watch of this was done at home, and I think that lost a little something for me. But when this was coming out, man, I was ready. Theaters were back. We needed a big movie to be excited about. And I think that's what Tom Cruise, in fact, I know that's what Tom Cruise was hoping for. Go back and listen to that leaked audio footage from people that wouldn't wear a mask. He was putting the industry on his shoulders, and that's what he wanted to deliver.
Yeah, you know what? As high as I was on this one, next week's film, I wasn't really looking forward to, mostly because of what Matt said. I hated that they were calling this Part 1, and we're going to have to pay another $20 to see how it quote-unquote ends. I don't know if the series is even going to end after the film we review in 2 weeks, but I was on pins and needles about whether or not I was going to like this movie. And I'll talk about my initial thoughts when I walked out of that theater, and I thought that me and Matt were going to review it. But yeah, I was not as excited. I thought this movie would have been the perfect way to go out. And the fact that they were coming back for not one, but two, scared me. But we'll get into all of that next week. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to end the series on The Final Reckoning. And then in 2 weeks, we will also reveal what series we're doing next, which is another action staple. But until next week, when we get to Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Thank you, boys.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Go!
It's Benji. Where am I going?
They're coming!
We're not ready.
Then get ready.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You can understand you're very upset. Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Your line's not long enough! No shit!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So let me get this straight. When there's a mission none of you can handle, you just leave word for a nameless man and hope he gets the job done. Is that it?
Should he choose to accept?
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I am waiting.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else?
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon series, the movies of the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park,
the ongoing Marvel series,
and so many more.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
He made it! He made it! I knew he'd make it.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Scheduling by Matt.
Read this. Slowly.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Listen. Talk to me. We can talk. Like gentlemen.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Reggie, did you recover anything?
Yes. Despite the aforementioned conditions of the hard drive you brought back, I managed to recover portions of 2 dozen email files. Also made what I believe to be a thoroughly promotion-worthy breakthrough.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You wanted me to listen. This is me listening.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
That was not easy, but I did it.
The release of Fallout and Rogue Nation, I don't know why I can't remember Rogue Nation's name, and Rogue Nation.
Because it's going to make a new world order. Outsiders. It's like, I'm glad we didn't bring back the car fucking elevator, I guess, by the finale of this film.
Well, it's funny you say that, because Cavill with that mustache, he does look like Scott Hall.
The original,
like Scott Hall pre-Razor when he was like in the AWA. Like, it's kind of scary. If they make a biopic, cast Henry Cavill.
I don't like Baldwin. I don't, but I like him in this.
Yeah, any sane person wouldn't like Baldwin, but I'm with you. Well, I like
him. I've never had to work with him. So.
Yeah, neither have I, fortunately.
It's like Val Kilmer. I like him, but I'm grateful I've never had to work with
him. Yeah, exactly. All right, we meet Erica Sloan and Anthony Walker, played by
August Walker.
Oh, August Walker, yeah, sorry. We meet Erica Sloan and August Walker. And by the way, this was a crew suggestion. This wasn't even in the original script. Adam, how do you feel about this connection? Oh, go ahead, Matt, go ahead.
No, I'll save it for after Adam goes, because I think we're going to say the same point.
Okay, Adam, go ahead.
The trailer makes you think this is going to be a lot more dour than it actually is.
True.
Yeah, the like, break this doesn't that they have.
I was just going to say, Adam, sorry. This doesn't have the Dark Knight Rises.
Ethan's friends walk in as Julia then leaves. And we hear... let's see. I'm sorry. My wording on this is fucked up. Ilsa says that she understands why Alan believed in him and that I am... I'm sorry. This is Sloan. Sloan says that she... And then in 2 weeks, we will review the Final Reckoning. Is it called the Final Reckoning? Yeah, that's the name of it, right?
Reckoning. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to end the series on the Final Reckoning and then...